Right. Good evening and welcome. Welcome to the Financial Markets Group public lecture. This evening we're very fortunate to have Professor Robert Schiller coming to talk to us. Professor Schiller is at the Cowles Foundation at Yale, where he's been for several decades, I think.
Yeah? Several.
Well, anyhow. Robert has for long been studying the vagaries of financial markets, why there seem to be excessive variations in price, and then he did a fascinating survey of what or why people sold on October the 19th, 1987, and more recently he's been asking questions about why do financial markets seem to be incomplete in the sense that there are not available certain contracts that might seem to be both possible and adding to general social welfare. And I understand he's actually taken this step, which is a very good thing for an academic to do, of putting his time where his mouth is, actually trying to start some financial exercises himself. Robert, very glad to have you here.
Thank you. Well, I'm not trying to talk. Well, actually, I am talking about some of those things. The business that you referred to, I founded a company. Can you hear me all right without standing by the microphone? Called Case Shiller Weiss Incorporated. And we've been trying to promote new financial contracts that would help individuals, like futures markets for real estate and the home equity insurance. I'll come back to one of these things, but that's not primary. So, let me see if my transparency is working. Is that visible?
Yeah.
What I'd like to do here today is think about kind of the big picture on risk management with a certain perspective regarding.
Can you put that over and up a bit, please?
Maybe I turn this.
Wake it further up in the screen.
I'll try to keep it at the top margin. Okay. So, there really is a problem seeing the lower part of the, apparently.
Actually,
oh, this thing is in the way. Can I move this?
Where did I?
Okay. I'm writing a book on this topic, but it's not as far along as I would like. What I'm trying to do is think of the really big picture of risk management in practice. Kind of is born from frustration having gone for many years to finance seminars in which the speaker will tend to write at the beginning of the lecture this present value utility function. It's a summation or integral of discounted utilities of consumption, which identifies the problem that people face, accurately, I think, maximizing your lifetime utility. But they never really get down to the practical issues of how these the problems are kind of presented in this abstract general form without fixing on the parameters. The basic problem that we face in dealing with risk in financial markets is a lifetime one, or you can even say longer than lifetime. Most of us have concern about our children or potential children or about our grandchildren. So we have a horizon of 100 years, probably, in what we care about. And we're concerned, I'd like to, in the title, which has now disappeared from the screen, I use the word livelihoods, because that to me suggests a long-run concern. And so, ultimately, finance is for people, for individuals, and the question is, how do we manage these really long-term risks? There's many perspectives. This is such a broad issue. I'm thinking of how does this translate into practical advice, it's such a broad potential issue that I find that seems to require knowledge of too many things. Law, economics, political science, psychology, history. So I can't speak authoritatively on this, as I hoped I would. But one way of narrowing this down a little bit, which I find useful, is to think about the basic problem as one of invention. That is, I want to look at history of risk management and single out events that could qualify as new inventions that somebody made and that were copied around the world. I'll come back to that. That's actually the first item on my outline. And then what I want to do is think about the nature of livelihood risks, the risks to this present value of our consumption that we are supposed to face. And I'm going to be kind of random in what I select to discuss, but briefly to indicate, to remind you of some of the uncertainties that we face and that we'd like our risk management to deal with. Then, next two items, three and four. Well, three, I wanted to remind you, there's a lot of discussion of information asymmetries, which prevent people from managing. I'm standing in front of it now, aren't I? There's no way. What if I read up here then? So, and fourth, I think that a problem that is much more central to this than many economists are accustomed to thinking is there's some barriers of human psychology. We're talking about individuals managing their risk properly. There's so many good ideas, it seems, that never go anywhere because people don't seem to get it or they don't respond well to some risk management device. Then I want to talk about some of the inventions that we've already seen. You may not be accustomed to thinking of these as inventions. They have both aspects of inventions and aspects of political foolishness to them. But I'm going to try to focus on the good part of these. All of these things I mentioned here were started by some inventor who had a strange new idea and have since been copied the last one's not everywhere, but a lot of places. And then I want to talk about some of the inventions that that seem to have some promise and that I've been advocating. And then finally talk about trends in risk management and where we're going in the future. So let me first, though, talk about item number one on this list, which is what I'm thinking about. This is kind of an unusual perspective to put on risk management, that is, of inventions. What are inventions? Well, something that the patent office would think of as an invention is something that has a number of elements that are necessary for a desired work result that work together with a simple logic and is not obvious. Right? Isn't that what a patent office expects of an invention? Now, usually patent offices do not allow patents on ways of doing business. So most of the things that I have would not be patentable at a patent office. But I think that's because of a rather restrictive definition of an invention. So an example of an invention is something like life insurance. Okay? And I think that if it were purely, if we didn't have this restriction against patenting ways of doing business, this is a patentable idea. It's whoever thought of it first was being very clever and original. It has a number of elements. I'm using this just as an example. The contract, the standard contract, which is defined with many elements to that, definitions of losses and claims. There has to be a form, corporate or mutual, for the insurer to allow the contract to spread and proliferate as it has. It has to be a database of loss experience and a mathematical model of the probabilities so that they know how to write these contracts in ways that they don't lose money. And then there has to be some kind of regulation to ensure people that they really will be paid. Now, I think you agree that this is an invention. Is it obvious? Well, of course, inventions seem obvious ex post. We live with these all our lives. If you look at the history of insurance, however, it doesn't seem like it was so obvious an idea. There were, in ancient Rome, burial clubs. What it was, you could join a club, and then when you died, your family would get funeral expenses. Somehow, that was life insurance. But why was it so limited? there are tontines in France that were developed in the 17th century. It looks like life insurance, but they got it backwards. It seemed to me that what they were doing was you get into a group of people together and they place a bet, which of one of us is going to live the longest? And all the money goes to the one who lives the longest. But early inventions, like, they seem to have elements of gambling to them, and they failed, and it wasn't obvious how to do this. The thing about inventions, and this is what interests me, is that they, well, first of all, they tend to be anonymous. It's not the professors who developed them, well, I wish it were, generally, but it's usually some person who's got a practical problem and figures out an answer. When it happens, it's sudden. The world sees that there's a new idea that works. Suddenly they're everywhere. It's copied all around the world. Okay, so that's what I wanted to try to do here, is to look for inventions for the basic problem of solving lifetime risk management. There aren't that many of these inventions. They're not that successful. But there are something. And so that's one thing that I wanted to do. The problem, though, in inventions for dealing with lifetime risk problems is that the success is not quickly observed. When I'm thinking of when the first inventor of the telescope, who was anonymous Dutchman, wasn't it, invented them, Galileo had about 2 months to make his discoveries before the markets were swamped with telescopes. You couldn't go anywhere in Europe and not encounter these telescopes for sale. But the inventions that deal with the real huge problem of managing our livelihood risk are not observed. It's hard to observe the success. I think sometimes there is observation and there is copying. Okay. So before I get into these inventions, I wanted to talk. This is kind of a reminder to you of the uncertainties of our livelihoods. Okay. The first thing is, I don't see many people talking about longer-term uncertainties to individual livelihoods and adding them all up. There are a lot of sources of uncertainty, probably each of the risks that we face has a low probability. But we have to kind of remember how many things can go wrong in 30 years. So I have this parable of the 40 thieves. So there's 40 of them, and each of them is only going to take a small fraction of your income. But there's 40 of them, and it's kind of hard to count the thieves. You can't remember them all. They're all out there, lurking. So I have these little calculations. If it's only 5% of your income is taken with a probability of 0.05, you would almost say, well, each of these thieves is meaningless to me. What's 5% of my income? But there is a probability of, still sounds small with this example, of greater than 20% of your income being taken. Also, on the assumption of independence, we tend to assume that all these different risks are independent of each other, but who's to say they are? That's just because we've been trained in statistics to assume independence unless otherwise. But the risks tend to come, one causes the other. So for example, in the Asian crisis, people say, wow, we had a balance of payments crisis, we also had a banking crisis. What luck? Well, our long-term capital management, who said the spreads in one part of the world were widening and they were widening in the other part of the world. Well, sometimes things are not independent. So there's other, if you have 40 thieves, and if one of them robs you, they go in sequence, then all the other ones are emboldened to rob you too. Then the probability, even if it's only this 0.05, 5% situation, the probability of your keeping anything is only 0.34. So the lesson is, we have to kind of keep a perspective about our livelihoods and understand that things can go wrong. I don't want to be alarmist. I want to be enlightened about risk management. This is the Madison data on real per capita GDP for six countries, since 1900. And everybody's growing. Now that is maybe a cause for some feeling of safety. Everyone has grown for the last 90 years. But of course, you know, that's only one point in history. We don't know the next point will be like this. The thing that is really striking is that the growth rates seem to be kind of irregular. Notably, this heavy line, which I made the easiest to see, is Japan. It seemed to be doing very little in terms of growth, but it stayed very low until around after World War II. And then, man, it just crossed everybody and shot up. People like to mention Argentina, which was then more than twice as high as Japan. And it was looking, at this period, pretty much like the United States in growth. But then the U.S. and Japan both started growing faster. And it didn't. Which one is Argentina? I can't. I guess it's hard for me to read. But it's one of those in there that's not doing anything and gets crossed by Japan. We just see the one turn down in USSR. So what this shows is that there's a lot of variability. I don't think anyone forecasted these changes. And so far, the kind of variability that we observe here is the one of either breaking through the way Japan or Korea or some other countries have or not. But we don't know what the kind of uncertainty would be. Now, one thing that is kind of striking that suggests a little bit of uncertainty to me is how unequal, and this has been probably made many times before, the income distribution in the world is. And I'm using the Penn World Table data on gross domestic products. If you believe them, the United Arab Emirates is the richest country in the world, but they don't account for many people. After that comes the U.S. With a per capita income in 1992 of $25,000. UK is very close, I don't remember exactly, but let's look down to the 75th percentile. That puts us in Bulgaria, Malaysia, or Uruguay in 1992. And look how much the income has dropped between the 95th and the 75th percentile. It dropped by about two-thirds. Now the fact that there's some bite to this income drop is suggested by looking at life expectancy down about 3 years. So 75th percentile is pretty high in the world, and yet we're seeing a big drop. We go down, I was trying to tell a story. Imagine, I should have started with this. Imagine that you were going to place a bet, and the outcome of the bet would determine who you trade places with in the world. So the kind of, your odds are anywhere along this continuum. Actually, your expected outcome is right here at the median, right? Pakistan, Honduras, and Laos with a per capita income of $2,000 and a life expectancy for a male of 56 years. But you could end up in the Ivory Coast, Guyana, or Senegal with a per capita gross domestic product of $1,600 and a life expectancy of only 47 years. I like to put these life expectancies in because they point out that income differences that are observed really do matter. And there's a lot of things when you're short of income that suffer. Now, I'm not, again, being alarmist, I'm mentioning things, risks. We're seeing a global economy, and the percentage of trade, this is world merchandise exports as a percent of world GDP, has been growing quite rapidly. The world is becoming more unified. So you wonder how secure each of us is with our income, or various people within our country or countries. There was a recent paper by Borjas, Freeman, and Katz that looked at the decline in the income inequality, from the increase in income inequality in the United States, and tried to see how much of it was attributed, could be attributed, to two world factors. One is increased immigration from abroad. Mexicans and other people from Latin America are moving in. And the other one is increased trade with less developed countries. Now, in this period from 80 to 95 in the United States, the actual change in log wage differentials between high school graduates and high school dropouts, that's people who don't complete high school, is 0.109. So they lost about 10% in 15 years relative to the graduates. More dramatic between college grads and high school grads, like almost 20%. So the total was a 30% widening between dropouts and college grads. So their analysis tried to find out what fraction of that is due to these world trade issues and immigration issues. For the high school grads versus dropouts, they attributed 52% of this 10% decline to these two factors. Okay, what's happening is they're making cheap products in Hong Kong, importing them, and those imports are competing with the products that these people are making in the U.S. But the effect on high school versus college wasn't very big. So Borjas, Freeman, and Katz said, it's these people who are at the bottom of the educational ladder who are really threatened by this. Now I just kind of mentioned some others. Environmental uncertainties. There was a recent article in Scientific American written by some oil experts, The End of Cheap Oil. And they had forecasts for oil production by various parts of the world. And so the solid lines, the regular lines are history, and this is their forecast. I thought this is really striking. If this is going to happen, if oil production is going to drop off in all these major regions by as much as they say, then we've got another thief operating. I don't know if I believe that, but you've heard about the Kyoto Protocol. They're worried about greenhouse gas emissions, and various nations of the world have agreed to to cuts of levels of emissions. There's concern about what that might mean for our economies. William Nordhaus, who's at Yale, tried to find out what experts on environmental issues think about one environmental risk, but that is the carbon dioxide levels. And Nordhaus devised two scenarios and asked what the scenarios would mean. Both scenario A and scenario C are considered within a plausible range, I'm told. So scenario C is a 6-degree increase in global temperatures by 2090. And he asked them, what is the probability of a high consequence outcome, defined as a lowering of global incomes by 25%. The economists thought it wasn't very likely, but the scientists, it was just incredible. The difference, the scientists thought there was a 55, if scenario C happens, which is not that unlikely, they thought there was a 55% chance of another Great Depression from that cause alone. Economists thought it was a 3.5% chance. But even the 3.5% chance says it makes my list of potential thieves, right? I have a number of things here that I... let me just mention a couple others that I'm going to cut in the interest of time. One is, there have been studies about why it is that economies seem to prosper, some more than others. And there's a literature, emerging literature, about social capital, arguing that the quality of social organization matters for an amount of trust, seems to matter for economic development. And it was found that, really reporting from a paper by Laporta et al., there are very great differences across countries in a sense of trust for other people in these countries. And these differences tend to be changing through time. The level of trust in the United States has dropped dramatically, according to the survey, since 1960, from 58% thinking that others can be trusted to 37%. And it appears that countries that where people trust each other are countries that are more prosperous. So the amount of trust seems to be one of these vague things that you could easily forget about, but another factor that might add to uncertainty. And the last thing I'm going to mention about actual uncertainties, because of our tendency to make nominal contracts defined in currency terms, inflation imposes another risk on our livelihoods. For example, a typical pension holder at TIA lost 70% of the value of their annuity to inflation. People, I'll come back to this in a discussion of behavioral principles. People don't seem to be very enlightened about inflation. For example, alimony and child support payments in most countries of the world, as far as I have been able to determine, are determined in currency terms and not indexed, even though they're lifetime contracts. I did a study in Turkey where the inflation rate is 70% a year, and they denominate them in Turkish lira without indexation. Okay. Well, that was just a reminder of the diversity and to impress upon you perhaps the importance of thinking about both aggregate national income variation and changes in the income distribution within population. And I hope it would remind us that these should be central issues when we talk about reform of Social Security or other things. What are these risks and how are these risks going to be dealt with? We could see big changes in the relative standing of nations in 30 years, and we could see dramatic changes in the income distribution within nations. And I think we should be thinking now about what to do. This is a risk management problem because at this point, they're not known. After, if we wait 30 years, then we will discover that some social group is hit really hard, right? It's easier to deal with it now, ex ante. That's what risk management is all about. So we have to think about it when it's only some vague possibility. Problems we have, and this is a reminder from elementary finance. There's two main problems I wanted to stress. One is information asymmetries, another one is psychology. Information asymmetries are, as in Akerlof's lemon, a very common cause of inability for people to manage risk. If you don't know, in an insurance example, if you decide to create an income replacement insurance policy, for example, and you open it to the public and let anyone join, well, all those people who know that they're going to run out of income will come in. Okay, that's an adverse selection problem. The moral hazard problem is a problem that they'll quit working. Once you're insuring them, then they'll get lazy all of a sudden. Both of these problems are reasons why some businesses that could manage risks don't exist. And they're both reasons for government intervention. It's, you know, one of the reasons why we have social insurance is because you can deal with adverse selection by insuring everyone. And the government can deal with moral hazard because it has better powers to monitor sometimes than private businesses. These problems are also changing through time as information technology changes. I'll come back to that. Now, the other thing about difficulties in creating risk management for the kinds of risks that I've just talked about is that it seems that human psychology is not, it provides important barriers. And if you look at people who tried to do new innovative techniques like indexing, for example, I'll come back to that, they say that the public was surprisingly unreceptive. Why is that? Well, there are a number of reasons. One, people fail to appreciate the risk. Well, I was just trying to impress upon you the risks to changes in incomes in the long run. People don't think of these long-run risks that often. The psychologists, Tamat Kahneman and Tversky, talk about the availability heuristic. We make judgments about what's probable based on our intuition. And our intuition is ultimately formed by scenarios that come to mind. So certain things that appear risky may come to mind easily, whereas other ones that are more arcane and have many facets do not. So for example, the stock market seems to seem awfully risky. And that's because it's in the paper every day, because there are prices observed every day. We apparently exaggerate the risk of the stock market. And this is the Nazi failure theory of the risk premium, of the equity premium. The vividness effect. Anything that comes along with stories and excitement tends to be remembered more. I was quite struck in Turkey. We're trying to understand why there was no demand for index bonds in Turkey, of all places. Well, there's not none. When the government created them in 1996, there was some demand, but it's small. And why, in a 70% inflation variable, why wouldn't they flock to them? Well, I did a survey over there to ask them. Well, there are various facets. It's not easy to answer these reasons. But one thing that was really striking to me was that people did not seem to be focused on the uncertainty about the Turkish lira. They knew that there'd been all these problems in the past, but we had questions expressly eliciting their sense of uncertainty. And I just don't think it was prominent on their mind. So people are not worried about these things. Framing refers to a psychological tendency for people to think differently about the same thing if it's just presented in a different order or with different associations. There was a famous study in which psychologists asked people whether they would like to buy an insurance contract against a certain kind of risk. And they had two versions of the question. One question described the contract but did not use the word insurance. The other one merely said, this is insurance. When they said it was insurance, the people who were interested in buying it rose dramatically. Acceptance of risks. People are risk averse in a way, but they're not consistently. You know, there's some, well, we see people gambling, for example. But it's not just gambling. Kahneman and Tversky in their prospect theory argued that people have a tendency to want to get away scot-free. In other words, they think, well, probably there's low probability that it's happening. I'm not going to pay to insure against it because probably it won't happen and I will have gotten away with it. This is what happened to long-term capital management, too. another thing is imitation and information cascade. People imitate what other people are doing because they assume other people know, or maybe for psychological reasons. As a result, everything, if you assume that everyone else is doing it because they know, but they're only doing it because everyone else is doing it, then we're not in a situation that's very good. There's been a lot of literature in theory recently by Banerjee and Dick Giandani, Hirschleifer and Wealth and others about them, describing perfectly rational cascades, and there may also be an irrational element as well. Fifth is money illusion, and this is something that I think is a well-established phenomenon. And let me go back to Turkey again. Just to go back to the alimony payments, okay? Why would they do that in Turkish lira when they know that the inflation rate is going to be 70% a year? We asked people that and tried to understand. The reasons are complicated, but somehow they don't understand or they don't feel comfortable with indexing. They know what money is. People want the money. Shafir, Diamond, and Persky, in their study of money illusion, found that you could explain to people that they're getting a wage increase only because of inflation, and they understood that it was only because of inflation. And then they asked, do you want it anyway? And they said, yes, I want it. Another issue is fairness and private property. People are very concerned about fairness, and things have to be done in such a way that it appears fair. They also have senses of private property, and anthropologists find evidence for private property in all cultures, almost all cultures. So let me talk about some inventions that actually have importance for the big risk management. Now, the first invention that, these are old, the first invention is not the cleverest, but let me mention it because this is really the important one, the most important actual method that we have, progressive taxes and means-tested services. You may think of it as a risk management device, ex ante. When they first imposed it, after your income is already decided, you may be angry, because if you're rich, you'd be angry. But ex ante, when you're thinking about your children and grandchildren, we all know that our children may not be talented, they may be low income, they may have problems, not just talent, but executive dysfunction or any of a number of problems. And they will be saved by this system. So people will vote for this system because of that, as a risk management device. Problem, of course, is moral hazard. Well-known problem. So what we do is we give food stamps, public housing, and Medicaid, but no MTV. Dealing with public perceptions of fairness is very important. We couldn't get a negative income tax in the U.S., but they finally came up with the earned income tax credit, which is you've got to work to get your negative income tax. So people in the United States who have children and are working, earning $5,000 a year, they're paying minus $2,000 in taxes. It's a clever idea, maybe it's an invention of sorts, to deal with the public perceptions of fairness and the moral hazard issue. But it has problems because it phases out at an early income level and it imposes a terrible marriage penalty. So if you are earning $5,000 a year, don't get married in the United States. So that's important. Let me talk about some others. Now this one is actually very interesting. I think it's an invention, an anonymous inventor. And you may not be familiar with this because I understand that this term is not used in the UK. But you have it, or you had it, I'm not sure. Let me talk about what I know. In 1884, in Bismarck's Germany, he introduced, the Bismarck government introduced a system of insurance against work-related injuries. And what they did is they said, every industry in Germany has its own mutual association, and every company in that industry pays in amounts to that mutual association, and if anyone is injured, there will be a schedule of payments, and the injured person takes the money from the fund. And industries that have a lot of injuries have a higher assessed rate that they pay to the fund. Okay, that spread rapidly to almost all countries of the world. Now, why is this an invention? And this being the first one, maybe the best idea of them all. Why is it such an important idea? It appeared, as far as I know, maybe you can tell me, without any economist. This is an anonymous bureaucrat in Bismarck's government. Maybe Bismarck thought of this, I don't know, but probably not. Why is it such a good idea? Well, the economist comes along later, John Commons, University of Wisconsin, said it's the internalization principle. That is, prior to 1884 in Germany, if you're injured at work, you had to sue your boss. You go into court, the boss would say, I know it's a little bit unsafe, but if everyone's just careful, they won't get maimed by the machine at our work. And this guy was just being a little careless, so you'd lose the suit. But of course, you know, it's impossible to prove that you just want to create a market incentive for employers to be safer. So this does it. It does it by industry. Okay, and when they did it in the U.S., they said, for big companies, we're going to do it by company. Okay. Now what happens if you are maimed for life, you cannot work again because you had an accident with a machine. It's no fault. You get paid from the whole industry. You're sure to get the money for your lifetime. It actually works. And it creates a market incentive. Now, as far as I've been told, in the UK, this system has gotten muddled up and doesn't work the way Bismarck wanted it to work. What you do here, and maybe someone can tell me I'm wrong, you just have inspectors looking at whether factories are safe enough. This is different. Inspectors can't know whether it's really safe. What you do is create an incentive. You internalize the costs on the industry. So, okay, it's an important invention, but it's very small. It only does unemployment insurance. Now, this is a UK invention. I don't know if you know that. It was done here first, 1911. It spread rapidly to almost all countries. It's interesting that, according to my dictionary, the word unemployment didn't enter the English language until 1888. So this was only, 23 years after the word was invented. How can we do this? The U.S. was among the last countries to adopt it. It didn't sound right. Henry Ford, particularly, you've heard of him, said it's a harebrained scheme if I've ever heard of it, because all it does is protect you for 26 weeks. He said, I tell all my workers they should have at least 26 weeks savings on hand. They can do that themselves. But what happened is we had two things happen. Well, we had the Great Depression in 1935 that happened, and all this objection was overruled, and it was instituted in the United States. John R. Commons, who was so inspired, having understood workers' compensation now, said we should have the internalization principle operate here too. So he proposed an experience rate. It became known as the American Plan. He said employers that lay off a lot should pay higher unemployment figures. Should work just like workmen's compensation. To this day, United States unemployment insurance follows the American Plan. I understand it doesn't work that way here. It sounds like it's a good idea to me, but as I was saying, some of these, maybe tell me why it isn't. It sounds like some of these inventions don't move too smoothly. Social Security, invention, that was Bismarck again in the 1880s, spread to almost all countries. The United States, it's always a holdout. Anything like this sounds like socialism. So it wasn't until we got hit by two shocks, the Great Depression of the 1930s, and also penicillin and other drug and medicine was extending life expectancy. So people didn't expect to retire. They expected to die before they retired. Suddenly we've got all these poor people who don't have any money. So the government finally did what they had to do. I'll tell a very simple version of what Social Security is. Let's suppose that there's no population growth and no income growth, okay? But this one event, life expectancy, suddenly increased in the 1930s. All of a sudden, people live longer, but they didn't save for it, so they don't have any money. What do? You're Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Obviously, you give them the money. You take it from the young people who are working. The old people can't work anymore. Let's say you give $100,000 in total to the old. And what does he say to the young? Well, we'll pay you back when you're old. How will we pay you back? Well, we'll take it from the then young. We can do this forever, right? It's called a pay-as-you-go security, social security system. Every generation loses the $100,000 when they're young, and they get it back when they're old. What are they losing? They're losing the interest on $100,000. The present value of the interest on $100,000 is, of course, $100,000. So forever, society is stuck with the burden of the $100,000 given to that first generation. And it's all fair. This is good risk management. They had no way of knowing they were going to live longer. But when you think of privatization proposals now, it kind of misses the point. The reason we're getting so low return on Social Security is because of exactly this effect here. We can't suddenly invest it. Anyway, Social Security is a wonderful invention, and it is a risk management device, if done right. In a sense, it was the way it was instituted, but it's not currently discussed in those terms. In fact, in the United States, the proposals for privatization seem to be just backwards. Now we're going to put money in the stock market, and you get whatever the stock market does. The Social Security should be thought of as a risk-sharing device between generations, within generations, and also we got to remember that there's a whole world out there, and risk management doesn't have to be done by one country in isolation. Okay. Talk about indexation. Now, this is another example of anonymous, not quite completely anonymous inventors stealing the show before the economists. If you look historically, index-linked debt, which you know well, which is what 20% of the national debt in the UK, was proposed by UK economist Joseph Lowe in 1837. It was eloquently advocated by UK economist William Stanley Jevons in 1875. And here's the Yale University advocate, Irving Fisher, 1911. So you finally did it about 100 years after Jevons. Okay. U.S. adopted index-linked debt in 1997. So this is an example of slowness to adopt an important invention. But it's a little curiosity that I thought I'd tell you about. Who really invented index-linked debt? Well, I'll show you something here. I don't know if you can read that here. This is an index-linked bond. Now, I can tell you the interesting thing about this, this is a facsimile of the original bond. Let me just tell a little story about whose name we can associate. This was engraved on a copper plate by one Paul Revere. You heard that name? He was the official engraver for Massachusetts Bay Colony, and he's known to Americans for riding through every Middlesex country and town, city and town, shouting, "The British are coming." But he was a patriot at the time of the Revolutionary War. He really should be known for this, because this is a far more important contribution, having created. It's really remarkable that his name appears in this. If you read what it says here, and you might have a little trouble to read, it defines the first index number. Here it is in Paul Revere's hand. He did scratch this backwards on a copper plate, but you can now read it. The index is 5 bushels of corn, 68 pounds, and 4/7 parts of a pound of beef, 10 pounds of sheep's wool, 16 pounds sole leather. Now, what else? I can't even read this too well, but there is, I think this is the first, but certainly the first index-linked contract. Unfortunately, it had a bad ending. This is during the war with England, as I mentioned before. After the war, it was a very chaotic time, and there was civil war. It's an often forgotten fact. There was Shays' Rebellion in 1786. The American soldiers who were paid in depreciated currency were really mad, and they knew how to fight, and they were at arms. And the guys who bought these bonds were getting their full real value, and it became a sore point. And so in 1786, the government retired the index bonds, and it was not done again until 1997 in the United States. Okay. So let me then conclude by talking about some emerging inventions. Now I have about 10 emerging inventions that are kind of inspired by some of the inventions that we've just talked about. Only loosely. The problem with a lot of these inventions is that they deal with certain problems, but they leave a lot of them unsolved. And a lot of major gaps are left yet unsolved. I won't talk too much about home equity conversion, but I talked about it here with some of you last Friday, with a real estate conversion. But one really important source of risk that's not being solved at all is that individuals tend to own homes in their own town. For people who retire, that is often practically the only thing they own, except for claims on Social Security. And yet, as you must know, it's a risky investment. So why do we tolerate that in our society? Why do we tolerate this kind of concentration of risk on one person? Well, there have been a lot of contracts that have been tried here. And some of these you've heard about, and they're actually out there. The problem is that they're not being snapped up. And there's some, I think, sort of a behavioral problem. People don't appreciate what this. Reverse mortgage is a contract aimed at elderly people where when your house poor, you're living in a house, you get payments from the bank instead of paying to the bank, and then they get the house when you die. Home equity insurance is one that I mentioned earlier. I've been advocating in my company, Case Shiller Weiss, and I think we've got about three insurance companies that are seriously interested. I hope we can get this going in the United States. All it is an insurance policy that pays you if your house declines in market value as defined by an index. Shared appreciation mortgages is a UK phenomenon only. It's the Bank of Scotland. And it's not sold as a risk management device. Now, I think these guys are clever. They found the public will snap these up. What it is, the simplest form of this, and I guess you can do this, right? Call your, I got on their website, and they're advertising these. But what it is, in one extreme form, you can borrow 25% of the value of your house and never have to pay it back. But when you sell the house, they get 75% of the appreciation on the entire house. Okay. Now that doesn't sound like it was designed to be a risk management device. But these guys are smart. They know how to pitch things to the public. That apparently has appeal. People need the money and they're willing to give up the appreciation. But it really is a risk management device, because you're no longer bearing all of your uncertainty of housing. Housing partnerships were talked about last week, where you buy half the house and an investor buys the other half. And these are a couple other versions of that. The next invention, which I want to talk about, which I am fond of, comes from Chile. And I am kind of think we should follow their example. This is the Unidad de Fomento. I'm going to show you just the front business page of El Mercurio. When I was down in Chile talking to them, I told them, you stand alongside Paul Revere and other greats as having innovated something that the rest of the world ought to imitate. But they're so slow. I mean, most people have never, I bet you most of you have never heard of the Unidad de Fomento. It is moving, and they're now Uruguay, Ecuador, Mexico, and another have so it's spreading. It's just spreading geographically, and it won't get here for another 20 years. Let me tell you what it is. They have had problems with a lot of inflation. People have trouble indexing. Formulas confuse people. So they decided, here in Chile, we have to do something very simple. What we're going to do is define a unit of account called the UF. And the exchange rate between the peso and the UF is announced in the newspaper every day. So this is the exchange rate. What is it? This means tomorrow, today, and yesterday, I guess. So, 13,672 UF to the peso, which means that UF was worth about $30, okay? But this changes every day with the consumer price index. Here's the idea. Forget about pesos for anything important. I mean, you still buy the newspaper and your candy bars with pesos. You're lending money to someone. Forget about pesos. You do it in U.S., okay? Then, when you have to pay it back, you just open the newspaper and you multiply the U.F. by whatever number is given, and that's what you pay. Now, to American economists, this doesn't amount to anything as an idea. It's just nothing, right? I think it's a very important idea because it takes account of human limitations, inability to do indexation. Once you start thinking about UFs, then you solve the problem. You just talk in UFs, you forget pesos. Now, do Chileans really think of UFs? Okay, here is an ad for an apartment in El Mercurio. Okay, so two bedrooms, two baths from 1,099 UFs. Okay, and here's another one for 1,369. Where do you see this translated into pesos? It's not. People are thinking of UFs in Chile. This is another unit which is in their mind just like money. It's an amazing phenomenon. Also, I'm curious, notice how the price ends in 9? They didn't make the peso price end in 9. They made the UF price end in 9. So you know that people have made the change, and in Chile, UFs are like money, but they're indexed. Now the amazing thing is Chile is the only country that I know of that does alimony and child support right. When I was there, I asked, how is it done? In UFs, of course. Now why is it that in Turkey, they're doing Turkish lira? And then we asked them, you say, why do it in lira? Why don't you index it? And the guy said, I don't know, I don't think the father could afford that. Some confusion or something. We just do it in that form, then we're all set. And now I have, okay. Macro markets. This is, I wrote a book about this, so I have to say this near the end. The risk that we saw that we have inventions to deal with, the unemployment insurance and Social Security, tend to be intergenerational or interpersonal risks shared within the country among the people. But a lot of the uncertainties that we face are bigger than countries. They're how we will do relative to the rest of the world. At a time of global change, I think there's fundamental uncertainty about that. So what I proposed in my book was that we should set up stock market like vehicles, but where instead of pricing the dividend stream on a company, they're pricing national income. So we should set up a market for the UK, for Japan. Okay, and this is what it is. It would be an instrument that pays a fraction of the GDP of these countries. Just as a share is an instrument that pays a fraction of the earnings, well, as paid out by a company. Okay, and so if we have these, then people can really invest in the world. And they can short their own country. This is a step that people have to take, to learn to short their own country. There was a paper by Marianne Baxter said the risk premium puzzle is worse than you think. She concluded after, it was back here in the air mound, they concluded after extensive study that the optimal portfolio allocation for individuals in practically any country is to be massively short their own country. But even that doesn't work well enough because stock markets don't correlate that well with national incomes. I mean, more practically, when I was in Malaysia, I was advocating briefly to their authority. Why did Asian countries have this terrible crisis? Well, an important reason was that a lot of their foreign debt was denominated in dollars. And then when their exchange rate changes, then suddenly the debt is magnified. Why didn't they have a form of debt that insured them against bad outcomes? They should ideally have had a foreign debt that was indexed to their own GDP. Therefore, at this time of crisis, assuming that there was a crisis and their GDP fell, their debt would fall at the same time. That's risk management. Why shouldn't international investors be happy to buy bonds indexed to GDP? Just as they buy stocks, which are instruments indexed to the corporation's earnings. By analogy, it seems absolutely logical. But it's odd that it seems hardly to have been thought of or even mentioned. When I wrote my book, I was sure that people would come forward saying they had proposed the idea. Actually, it has happened. But now, Milton Friedman, when I gave this, he came forward. I thought, oh, now that's the guy who would have thought of this. He said, I have a paper to give you. He handed me a paper advocating index bonds. It's CPI index bonds. Well, anyway, that may be a far-off idea, but I want to just, this is my last slide, talk about the outlook for the future. There are several reasons for me thinking that the next 20, 30 years, we may see real advances in our ability to manage the kind of big risks that I've been talking about. The slowness that we've seen to adopt some inventions, like index bonds have been very slow to develop, and I mentioned home equity conversion. Don't be too discouraged about that in the long run historical sense. These things do change. And there's reasons to expect further change, that we're not just frozen in the situation that we're in now. One of them is that the finance profession has been doing a lot of thinking about derivatives and so-called financial engineering. And I think that there will be progress made that will help us better manage risk. I've been saying that they have to do a little bit more of what's called human engineering. Human engineering is making products work for real people. So a human engineer looks at a car and says, I want the steering wheel to be at a comfortable height and that sort of thing. We need that to combine financial engineering with human engineering. Up till now, financial engineering has actually had relatively little impact on personal risk management. It's mostly firms who deal with these. And people, individuals, can manage these risks themselves just by diversifying their stock holdings. I mean, I'm not saying it's not important, but I expect in the future that the kind of gradually growing enlightenment that we have will continue to produce new risk management products. Secondly, the rapid growth of information technology has fundamental effects on the adverse selection and moral hazard problem because it changed the information structure. The internet and computers are creating new ability to sort people, I'd say that, and to monitor their activities. So it's changing the information asymmetry. Just an example of where this has already had bite, just in the last few years. The mortgage industry in the United States has been transformed by a simple thing called a credit score. This company, Fair Isaac, has created a way of scoring individual credit risk. How likely are this person to default on the mortgage based on information that's available online? So if you as a mortgage lender can ask for someone's credit score and get an estimated probability that this person will default, this has had major effects on the mortgage industry in the United States because it has created a commoditization of mortgages. Banks or mortgage originators tended to have, they owed their dominance to the information asymmetry, that they knew these local people and they could judge whether they were going to default. But now it's becoming a commodity. Credit scoring means that we all know, anyone can find out the probability. So we don't need these local bankers, so it's changing the industry. But I think that the same kind of thing with regard to observing individuals' incomes or national incomes and being able to monitor them internationally are going to create new opportunities for risk management. Finally, I think that there is gradually growing understanding of human psychology and the barriers that it is posed to risk management. And as we understand them better, we can construct the products better. Just to give you an example in my mind of how much human psychology, how things that seem obvious now were not obvious a short while ago. An example that comes to my mind is the thing that came out recently that nicotine is addictive. Well, I mean, I just read this in the paper. I don't know. It seemed like the scientists have decided that nicotine is as addictive as cocaine. But 5-10 years ago, I don't remember reading that. That has kind of changed our thinking and policy about smoking. Why wasn't that obvious 5 or 10 years ago? I mean, talk to any smoker. Somehow things like that are not prominent and obvious enough in our discourse to form a basis for action of some sort. And so I think that this will be another source. So combining these three modes of improvement, I think. the next 10, 20, 30 years, we'll see new products for risk management that I can't imagine, not just the ones that I propose, but that will help us to deal with these risks that I talked about.
Thank you very much, Robert. We've got about 10 minutes for questions. Can I question at the back?
Taken off in where?
In Turkey. The CPI,
oh, that's good news.
Bonds are doing well. They are being marketed by, thanks to some fairly good economists who have managed to sell them to good clients. So I think a lot of this financial engineering needs to be marketed. My second comment has to do with your money illusion. I think money illusion is far more pervasive in the real world. As an ex-academic, I'm really shocked to see the extent of it on the front office and on the trading floors in an investment bank. And my last comment has to do with something that you mentioned, motivating your innovations, where you said that moral hazard and information asymmetries might give the government a better role in terms of monitoring of those markets. As far as international macroeconomics, macroeconomists like Yellen, Summers, everybody knows regarding the Asian crisis, it's the implicit social guarantees which have been given,
that's right,
which have been responsible for these crises. So I do not think that always the government has a very good monitoring technology relative to the private sector. A lot of the blame has been thrown at these governments for being very poor in monitoring those economies.
Yeah, although you won't see on my list bailing out major banks as a risk management device that I advocated. But I see the point.
Could you elaborate on the how the UF is determined?
Yeah, as in other countries, the CPI is announced only with a lag. So they take the 1 month lag CPI and they interpolate it. They have a some sort of exponential interpolation formula. And then they announce it with 1 month lag. So they know the next month already ahead. All right. In fact, anyone can know it, but they just publish it. That's why you notice it had yesterday, today, and tomorrow shown on the newspaper. And that's all it is. I have one for the U.S. on my website. I interpolated down to date. Although it turns out that the Bureau of Labor Statistics is doing that anyway for the CPI because something to do with pricing our index bond. But I also think that other kinds of index units of account might be useful. In Uruguay, they have something they call the Unidad. I forget the name now. But it is similar to Chile's, but it is based on a wage index instead of a price index. Now, it's not used. The only country that uses them widely is Chile. But I think that we might want to have more than one unit of account for different purposes, and there are reasons why things like Social Security might be tied to a wage index rather than a CPI. So it could be defined in another UF. Well, it makes so much sense. Imagine you're renting out a room in your house. You don't have to raise it every year. It's just always...
I can see that, but why would they be worried by it being called a price index?
Because, well, that's one of the mysteries of human behavior. They can't do it. Okay, let's think of it. Suppose you... imagine that you're setting some... imagine that you are setting a price or a fine or a fee, right? When you go into hotel rooms in the U.S., they'll have these little things on the wall saying, penalty for leaving false baggage to evade payment is $3 or 1 year in prison. I'm exaggerating. You want to know, wait a minute, this must have been written in 1890 or something, and they never index, they never increase. Well, so why do they do that? Well, imagine that you're on the commission setting the fine for this. Are you going to say on that hotel placard that your fine is $300 times one plus the CPI times to the it's not going to be done. You're going to say it's too complicated to index. But if everyone understands UFs, you just say the fine is 10 UFs. And once they're, that You know, it's a little bit like, why do we have the rule that you should stop at a red light even if there's no traffic coming? You could say to everybody, all right, we're not going to, you know, you can stop, and then if there isn't traffic coming, go ahead. We've decided that some simple rules, and so simple ways, if you have things priced in UFs, and everyone just routinely uses them, then everything, every last thing is indexed. And even little things like, okay, you buy a TV set, and then it doesn't work, and you take it back a month later, all right? Normally, of course, they give you your money back. They don't give you an indexed money back. They would never think of doing that. But if everything's in UFs, then every single thing is indexed. So it saves on all these problems. And that's why Chile is the most advanced country in the world in terms of indexation.
Philip.
Maybe I misunderstood. When you were talking about pay-as-you-go pensions, you talked about international diversification.
Doesn't happen.
What were you saying?
Oh, what I was saying, well, it could, see, actually, some of the Kotlikoff-Sachs proposal for the United States is that we have a invested, our pension money would be invested all over the world. I find it remarkable that a lot of the theoretical discussions of Social Security makes no reference to the rest of the world. And I think, see, really, there's a couple of aspects to Social Security. One is that people won't save, and paternalistic government has to force them to. The other one is really risk management. You know, if we are intelligent enough to save, then what else is there except risk management that defines a Social Security issue? And the point is that international risk management is very potentially very important. And it's not even considered or talked about in the Social Security discussion. So one thing, we could have the government doing international diversification, as has been proposed, or we could at least think about what individuals ought to be doing to diversify their portfolios, and then think about that as part of the big risk management picture.
I'm just thinking that's not pure pay-as-you-go kind of funding.
Well, I think, I don't have a concrete proposal. I mean, what I did propose in my book is that governments might short markets that are correlated with their own country, like macro markets, and therefore provide you an indexed risk that's safer than your own national income. Right now, they can't. There's very little international risk sharing, and that can be very important. Yes.
Is there a problem the last day if contagion dominates across markets?
If what predominates?
If contagion dominates across markets for large risks, then maybe there are risks, global risks, or climate diversity.
Well, first of all, that's right. That brings me back to one of my old favorite themes: is contagion and crises. It's my worst nightmare that macro markets would get started and there would be a macro market crash orders of magnitude bigger than any stock market crash. And this is one of the problems, in dealing with, I don't believe that markets are that efficient. And there's a wish that they were in the academic profession. And I wish they were too, from the standpoint of these mechanisms. Things would all work better if they were. But I think that they're not so inefficient that you can't rely on markets as a partial way of dealing with risk problems.
Last question, David.
Maybe one of the reasons why there isn't much international risk sharing across countries is maybe what matters to people a lot is how well off they are relative to their peer group, the people right around them, the people they see every day. And if that's true, then actually you're not that concerned if your GDP falls relative to the rest of the world. It's not a risk maybe that you take that seriously. Even if you look at countries where, say, life expectancy is 45 years relative to other countries where it's 75 years, that looks like an enormous risk ex ante. You don't know whether you're going to be born in that country or another country. But of course, the people there are looking at other people who've going to live that long. And maybe, in a sense, it's not that terrible thing if everybody else is experiencing.
Well, I think I would say what you're describing is a psychological barrier. I think it is a terrible thing that people in Ivory Coast have a life expectancy of 46 years. And it's the sort of complacency. Yeah, you live in a certain environment where people are dying of diseases that we have cures for, and you've accepted this, and you've seen it happen. And so people might not be clamoring for some solution. But I think that this is a psychological barrier. I think if you get these people's attention and explain that this life you're living, mean and short, I mean, they're not going to want that. And I don't think that this is ultimately a long-run barrier to some kind of better risk management.
Sorry, I'm not sure I understand how you have to think that sort of people with $1,000 a year ahead, guinea missile, whatever, are going to be able to diversify their risk across the rest of the world.
Well, they're already low. I was talking about uncertainty in a general term, that we might fall. I don't mean to say that we here might fall that low, but that was merely to sense the. So what should Ivory Coast do? I do have proposals for them, which I'd like to see implemented. And one is that their foreign debt should be denominated in their own national income, indexed in their own currency, their own national income.
It costs them a lot more up front to raise it.
But that's insurance. Not necessarily. It doesn't necessarily cost them more up front. They being, if you think of the CAPM, if they are more or less uncorrelated with the rest of the world, there won't be any risk premium. So they'll get their insurance for practically nothing. And that's exactly what, so they're 1,600. They have to worry, okay, they have to worry about falling to 1,200. And then things will be even worse for them. And so they rationally want to insure against a further drop. The way they can insure is to borrow from abroad in index to their own income. And this is extremely important for a country that's living so close to the, I would say, it's beyond the edge. If your average age of death is 46, that's beyond the edge. They cannot tolerate a 30% drop in their national income. And they really ought to insure against it.
But we've gone beyond the edge of our time. And it would be a terrible thing if we don't all go up to the reception, the senior common room. But before we leave, may we please express our appreciation for this fascinating, splendidly wide-ranging lecture. Robert, thank you very much. Now, you're all invited to a reception in the senior common room.